Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
Today on Crossover, we'll hear a performance of Mark Nykrug's Through Roses with celebrated actor Saul Rubinek, who speaks about the unique role he so brilliantly interprets.
Hello.
This is Saul.
Yeah.
Hi, Jill Pasternak here at WRTI in Philadelphia.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
Oh, I'm just fine, and I was delighted that I was able to speak with you about this amazing performance that you did. You should be getting an Academy Award. I have to tell you, you are spectacular, just spectacular. And I know a lot about music and a lot about acting, and you are phenomenal in this. It was just chilling. It was moving. I was limp. We were both, Joe Patty, the engineer, and I were limp after hearing you.
Wow, I'm amazed at the, you know, to tell you the truth, I haven't heard it. I mean, I got a tape of this, or at least a burnt CD, and given the fact that I've been performing it, I really couldn't listen to it, especially since I knew there was no visual aspect to it. I knew it would be well done because the CBC recordings were great, but I'm really glad to hear that it's effective just vocally.
Well, I have to tell you, I even said to Joe, I said, this reminds me of the old days of radio when you would listen to something and you would envision things, you know.
Sure.
But you are absolutely phenomenal in this. I just can't even begin to tell you. I do have a question about one area there that you say.
Sure, I'm glad to talk to you about anything you want to talk about.
Well, I'm a musician first. I had a whole career in music, and the way you speak about the job and getting there on time and playing the job and practicing and for what, it is so to the core of what a musician thinks about, and the way you. It is just brilliant. I just can't get over your performance.
Well, you know that Mark Nykrug wrote this.
Yes.
Probably 25, 26 years ago.
Oh, I didn't know.
And I had the opportunity this summer. One of the people who commissioned this work out of the 92nd Street Y.
Oh, okay.
Was Pinchas Zukerman.
Yes.
Pinchas Zukerman is concertmaster now at the National Art Center.
I know. I interviewed him not too long ago. Yeah.
And I just did this twice with him.
His parents were survivors of the Holocaust.
Not only that, his father was a violinist in Auschwitz.
Oh, my goodness.
You see, the genesis of this, I think, perhaps comes to a certain extent from that, you know, awful thing. And when I met Pinchas, it was his 60th birthday, and the National Arts Center, as a birthday present, he'd wanted to perform this again, basically financed this production. And I did it with him and other members of the orchestra and other soloists who came in. There were eight musicians, as you know,
yes,
to do this. And we did it twice. And we were so, I was, you know, pretty moved by the thing, and he was too. He had seen it, of course, and there's a film version of it.
Is there?
With Maximilian Schell.
Oh, my goodness. Really?
And that was done a while ago, which, you know, was kind of an interesting experiment, given the fact that this is really a stage piece. And Pinchas was so delighted with it that he wants to do it again with me. So we're trying to figure out, based on his schedule and mine, how we can perform this together again. Now, I'm doing this in New York on November.
Friday, yes, that's the Friday night, is it?
Thursday night, November the 13th, yeah. And I'm with various musicians in New York, and it's also with the Royal Conservatory of Music as part of their Music in Exile program. I've also been doing it as a standalone, and when this is broadcast, I'm also doing it November the 9th, which is the 70th anniversary of Kristallnacht, in Toronto. Uh-huh. As part of their Holocaust Education Week. So I'm trying to, and I did it with the English Chamber Orchestra in London in the spring.
I wanted to ask you a few questions just about when you're doing it and how it has impacted on your life. What do you feel when you're doing this? Mm-hmm. Can you live with this? It is such a devastating piece. I mean...
Well, you know, here's the thing. I got into this by accident. I didn't know what I was getting into. The Royal Conservatory of Music, which is essentially Canada's Juilliard, for want of a better description, mm-hmm. Had asked my agent in Canada whether or not I was willing to perform an narrative piece for actor and musician. I must admit, I thought I was going to be doing Peter and the Wolf.
Okay.
I had no idea that I was about to play an Austrian Jew who played the violin at Auschwitz in order to survive, and then later in life was unable to put bow to string, and that I was doing that a performance piece and not a narration. And it took a while for me to get that I was doing that, and then I only had like a couple of rehearsals, and then realized, wait a minute, these musicians, which are essentially scoring this 55-minute piece, they are not playing to me. Once they start, I've got 90 cues.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to fit my, well, libretto,
yes,
for want of a better word,
yes, exactly,
into the music. And although I have freedom between QA and QB,
right,
that may be as little as 10 seconds or 15 seconds or, you know, 30 seconds worth. Rarely is it as long as 30 seconds that I have freedom within that time frame. So it's a very... It was a memory piece, so the challenges of it were technical to begin with. The other thing is that my parents were Holocaust survivors, and although fortunately neither of them were in a concentration camp, they were hidden for 2.5 years. It's a subject matter that I had dealt with quite a bit growing up. I had written a book called So Many Miracles. I brought my parents back to Poland in 1986 to have a reunion with the farmers that had saved their lives, and that documentary exists, So Many Miracles. And, you know, and I've been involved in the subject matter throughout my life. So in a way, I was prepared for it. However, I have to tell you, my first reaction to the piece was, it's always been done by people in their 70s. It's always either in an old age home or an insane asylum, or that kind of thing. I said, look, I'm in my 50s. I'm going to look like I'm in my 50s. The character should look like he's in the prime of his creative life, and I need to reconceive it. And I was kind of hoping that when I spoke to Mark Nykrug for the first time that he would be intransigent and difficult, and I could get out of the damn thing and not have to do it. An hour's worth of memory work and all of that, you know. But Mark was, unfortunately, incredibly open and collaborative. And so I was screwed. And I had this new concept, and he was very open about the new concept of me doing it in a different way, that and I had to reconceive it. And the only thing that I bet him, and the only thing I said to him was, I said, look, you know, my problem with this is you wrote it, you know, 25 years ago. It's been performed all over the world in various languages. I'm now going to have to be performing this as an Austrian Jew with accent, with everything else. That's fine. But it's just not funny enough. And he looked at me with shock when we met. I said, I'm serious. He said, the only other person who ever said that to me was Maximilian Schell. And I said, well, you know, I'm in good company. He said, you can't get laughs here. I said, well, I wish I could bet you a bottle of Dom Perignon for every laugh I'll get. He would owe me about 3 or 4 right now. And I'm trying to reconceive the production. You got to understand, I did it in 1986, in the fall of 1986. I didn't do it again until 2006. I didn't do it again until 2008 in the spring. So there's a year and a half where I didn't do it. And then I performed it in the spring in London, twice in Ottawa, and I'll be performing it again
Toronto. Well, you know what it reminds me of, strangely? King Lear.
Well, you know, yes, because he's mad.
He's mad. Yeah, But you got the essence of the character and the problem and the the lack of belief of what he was going through, and he still is a musician, and it is amazing. I really have to tell you this. I'm not easily swayed, but
well, I think,
this
thank
is a
you
brilliant,
very much.
Brilliant performance.
I'm really glad it affected you, and I'm hoping that it continues to work for many years. My connection to it is a very good question. I'm not a Holocaust survivor. I'm a child of survivors. My parents weren't in a camp. And my connection to it is as an actor rather than as a musician. I wondered to myself, my connection was really simple. This man who played the violin in order to survive in Auschwitz has a kind of disjointed stream of consciousness, mm-hmm. memory. The musicians that are playing with him mm-hmm. are in his imagination, and they play Bach, Beethoven, mm-hmm. Mozart, Haydn, Wagner, all almost as if it's on some kind of acid. You know, it's skewed. It is those pieces, but they have been torn apart musically mm-hmm. by Nycrook. So it's essentially an atonal score.
Mm-hmm.
And the character can no longer play his own violin. And you're clear as you begin to put together the jigsaw puzzle of his memory, you begin to see that he's confusing Auschwitz with Carnegie Hall, you know,
yes,
and other
course.
Places that he'd
sure.
played.
Sure.
And eventually he disappears into his own music, and without having the ability to overcome what happened to him. So I thought to myself, well, how, rather than try to deal with it in terms of how am I going to prepare for a Holocaust piece, I haven't had to do that. I grew up with mm-hmm. those people, my parents, and all of that. I don't have to do a thing there. I had to imagine to myself, what would happen if I could no longer use my instrument, which is me?
Mm-hmm.
What would happen if I was no longer able to speak lines? What would happen if I was no longer able to perform characters and use my voice and my body and everything that I've been trained and learned how to do over the years? What would happen if I was exiled, as it were, from my own instrument? And I thought, well, there's a tremendous amount of ego destruction here, which could be quite amusing. And as a result, I've looked for humor in the arrogance of a man who would have to deal with overcoming what he knew were great gifts. And I thought that could be funny, and that could be touching when you realize what the cause of that is. So my connection to it has been in a way to, you know, to create a metaphor for myself that I could deal with rather than anything to do with the Holocaust. And I think as a result, I was hoping that way I'd be able to reach people.
Oh, he's demented in some way as well. I mean, but the point is that you have the character. You have the real person before he was destroyed. That you know who that person is.
Yes, because I performed in great places as well, and I've had the feeling of being someone who's had an audience and who's recognized for their work, and I know what it feels like to a certain extent not to have it, because the ups and downs of anyone's career. And I know that once you, my imagination, the piece is so powerful that it sweeps you along. You can imagine what it's like for a second to perform it. Once you, the button is turned on, once the music starts, it carries me. In fact, in that performance that you heard, which was the very first time I performed it ever mm-hmm. in front of an audience, it was recorded. And that's the recording you've heard.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And so I lost my lines a couple of times. I didn't know where I was. It was the music that reminded me.
Well, that's, but you are that person. I mean, there is no separation. That's what one feels, and that's what's so unbelievably moving.